Okay, quiet on the set, everybody. Stand by. Roll camera. Speed. Roll sound.
Speed.
Mark it. And cue talent.
Hello and welcome to episode 5 of This Week in Production. I am your host, Art Aldridge, and I have a very special guest with me in the Batcave today. Vern Mattson is a colorist and finishing editor. His current unscripted series include Moonshiners and Diesel Brothers, both on Discovery, Comedy Knockout on True, and Wrenched on Velocity. He was the colorist of the award-winning Oxygen series Unspeakable Crimes, The Killing of Jessica Chambers, and he has an upcoming A&E series on the preppy murder Death in Central Park. I first met Vern at the New Jersey Final Cut Pro User Group, and we've been friends and colleagues since. So let's jump right in with Vern. Welcome, Vern, to This Week in Production podcast. Happy to have you here in my home studio.
Well, thank you, Art. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you. I love your setup here. It's great.
Not too many people get into the Batcave, so consider yourself privileged.
I feel honored.
I will have to erase your memory after. Before we get into it, you're a colorist by trade, but tell us a little bit about your background, some of the things you work on.
Yeah. All right. The thumbnail is I've been in the business a long time. I started out at Major League Baseball Productions. I was a producer editor there for many years. Then I moved to a corporate production company. We did VNRs, and we did a lot of work for major pharmaceutical companies, oil companies. I mean, all these large Fortune 500 companies, and that was a valuable experience. During that time, I started getting a little itchy to do something different, and I started getting into independent film and short films. I ended up being a producer on a feature film back in the mid-2000s called And Then Came Love. It was with Vanessa Williams and Eartha Kitt and a bunch of other folks, and that was a lot of fun. So it introduced me to independent filmmaking. Now, circling back a little bit, for a time I was a partner in an HD production company back in the early 2000s. We had a Vericam. We had an Avid Symphony, and we started renting the Vericam out to productions that want to do HD video. And that's how I really got into seeing that, boy, you know, you can do a movie with this technology. It's fantastic. And the Vericam always looked great to me, still looks great to me to this day. It's a terrific camera, terrific format. So the writer of this movie, Kate Agentis, was a good friend from college, and we just reconnected. She moved back to the town I live in. And she said, I've been writing some films, some screenplays. She had worked in the business out in California, moved back with her husband here to North Jersey. And I said, let me read the script. And I read the script. I said, gee, we got to make this. And one thing led to another, and we ended up shooting it on Vericam. And so that was my first taste of independent filmmaking. And while I was a producer on that, I did cut the only thing I cut was a trailer for it. And it really gave me a taste for filmmaking. I really enjoyed it. And then we ended up doing a couple more projects. I ended up editing a feature that I also colored, because I just found color fascinating. Back when I was at baseball, I was the first editor to use Avid at Major League Baseball Productions. And one of the things that I did early on was, for the World Series, we did these MCI flashbacks, and we cut this old baseball footage. We did, you know, we had Carlton Fisk's home run and a couple of the moments. And I took that video, and just with the rudimentary tools in Avid at the time, we didn't have Symphony. It was like, holy crap, this is unbelievable. You can make this footage look really good. You know, when we were doing This Week in Baseball, we didn't do any color correction. It was just whatever came in, you cut it and you put it on the air. So that really started to open my eyes. So I tried to touch everything I did at Major League Baseball Productions with a little bit of color. And that carried on to my corporate work. And, you know, I sat through the color correction process on the feature film and Then Came Love. And then I got the opportunity to, you know, cut a couple of short films. I said, hey, I'll color it. And they said, great. So I started coloring that, and people liked what I did. So that kind of just snowballed, I guess. And then I decided to move on for my corporate gig, and I said, what is the talent that I could offer above editing to differentiate myself from other folks? And it was color. And so I just went for it, and I've been very fortunate over the years, and now I'm primarily a documentary and reality TV colorist, working with various production companies in the city. Do work for Discovery, for what else have I done stuff for? Oh, Sundance, Oxygen, a whole bunch of different channels. And I've also done independent features, you know, just coloring and things like that. So it's been a fun journey. And I've met a lot of great people, and I get to work with a lot of great people like you. So it's a real nice, it's been a great career change for me. I really enjoyed it. Sometimes I wish, gee, I should have done this earlier, but you know, my experience as an editor helps as a finishing editor on these reality shows, because a lot of times your reality shows are not truly finished when they come to color. You're always doing little tweaks and nips and tucks and things like that. So
you've seen the change in production. Production has changed. Probably when you started at Major League Baseball, there wasn't as many cameras, different types of cameras, not as many being used in production. So I would guess that the amount of differentiation coming through a production was probably pretty minimal. And nowadays, I would say the roadmap is who knows what you're getting when you comes in the door.
Absolutely. I mean, at Major League Baseball, it was Ikigami handheld cameras. That was what we captured with in our stories. We'd be getting the way that it was worked back when I started with Major League Baseball Productions was that we had 3/4-inch decks in every major league ballpark. And if there was a scoreboard camera operating or a TV camera operating, it was recorded and sent to our offices in New York. My first job was to screen them, which was you wrote down every shot, and that's where you learned what a good shot was and what a bad shot was. And it was all 3/4-inch tape, and it was all broadcast. And then anytime we went out and did a story or tried to do or needed to do a shoot for This Week in Baseball, it was all on Ikigami camera. So, and it was all standard definition. It was 720x46. That's it.
Did you ever work with Mel Allen?
Yes. Yeah.
Now, you may not know this because I'm sure you don't, because I never told anyone, but I used to love This Week in Baseball. And when
really?
I came up with the name for this podcast,
yeah,
that's what I thought of.
No kidding.
This Week in Baseball, we should have This Week in Production.
I love it.
I loved Mel Allen. I loved that show. Watched it every Saturday.
You know, it was a labor of love for all of us involved. You know, I'm still very, I hesitate to say how long I've been in this business, but I've been in a long time. And I'm still extremely close to many of the people that I started working with at This Week in Baseball. I've been doing projects with them all along. It was a great crew, a great group of people. And the show was just iconic. And to be a part of that, looking back on it, was just an amazing run. I'm very proud to have been associated with This Week in Baseball.
That's awesome. So one of the things that I've always wanted to get your take on is this idea of, you know, shooting log, even raw to some degree, but I think more people get fixated with the term log.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've honestly never shot log.
Right.
People, I think, seem to be fascinated with the term log.
Yes.
And I don't think they understand what it is. So tell me what it means to shoot log and what it means in terms of dealing with it for post-production.
Right, right. Well, like you said, going back to with This Week in Baseball, we shot 720x46, and now it's just been an explosion of different formats, from DSLRs to drone cameras to the handheld Blackmagic cameras, and you still have your very high-end Sony cameras, and and Panasonic has got some camera. I mean, there's I can't think of a time where if well-shot video looks so beautiful now. I mean, you always think, oh, wow, this we can't get any better than 720x46, but now it's just stunning. It's absolutely stunning. But because of all these different formats, there's so many different choices for people to make before you go out into the field. And like you said, there seems to be this, I don't know, aura around log. What log is, it basically, the image looks milky. And the idea behind that is to concentrate the image within a range so it's not clipped. The problem is that when you shoot log, you're shooting in color temperature. And you're not shooting, like, you're not white balancing and shooting. You can use a gray card. But, you know, that's getting outside my pay grade. But from what I've seen is, unless you have a lot of experience and can control your lighting to some extent, it can be difficult to get a really great image in log. I mean, what are you rescuing? You know, you're taking a chance by maybe not getting the shot as good as you want it, because it's not a what you see is what you get through the camera lens. You stand the chance of not getting exactly what you want. And what is the benefit of log? Well, the benefit supposedly is you get great highlights and great blacks. You can see detail in the blacks and you can see detail in your highlights. Well, how many shots are there of that? I mean, from what I've seen, well captured, well exposed, what's called Rec 709, which is just normal shooting, white balance is going to look better 99% of the time than something shot log in a run and gun situation. Now, if you're in a movie set and you want to drag out the highlights and drag out the blacks and any details in the blacks, then you can shoot log. But the way to do that is to have what's called a viewing LUT on a monitor. You should have a monitor on set and you have a viewing LUT. So you have your camera set up in log, and then you can apply a LUT within your monitor, professional monitor, and you can see what it's going to look like. So that way you have an idea of what you're at, what you're getting. In a run-and-gun reality-type situation, or even if you're in a corporate situation, we know how I know how stressed for time you are in these things. If you're gonna set your camera up for a daylight situation, all of a sudden your subject's gonna run inside, and you got to follow him. Okay, so then that's all messed up. All right, so you have to, if you're gonna use log, the best way to do it is to have a viewing LUT and a monitor on camera on a monitor, so you can monitor what's going to the camera. So it's a what you see is what you get, and that's the problem with log. It's not a what you see is what you get.
I think there's two things that I've seen just in talking with other camera operators. One is that they think that LUT means the camera does magical things. Like, you don't have to white balance. You don't have to set exposure. You're recording everything, and the man in the color correction suite is going to fix it. And is that true or not?
No, if it's clipped in your log, it's going to be clipped in whatever I can do. I mean, clipped video is clipped video. Poorly exposed video is poorly exposed video. I mean, the problem, too, is if you shoot too dark, then you have to brighten it up. Then you start to see noise in your blacks. If you shoot it too bright, you know, then you're going to lose detail and skin tones, especially. People just get washed out. And then you have to pull keys to get that color back in their cheeks or whatever. So, you know, I would say, if you want to shoot log, use it judiciously. Use it when you think it's going to benefit your production. I haven't seen the benefit of it.
It doesn't make your camera better.
Correct.
The camera is the camera.
Right.
The sensor is the sensor.
Right.
The range is already programmed into the electronics. The LUT is basically just taking out the color information, right, and you're doing it later, but it doesn't make your camera any better.
No.
And I'm sure maybe you can share if you have a like absolute horror story with a LUT or log process, because I've heard people say, well, we had a LUT on set, but that's not the LUT that, you know, they're grading with, and the look is completely off.
LUTs are weird things. I mean, they'll look good in certain situations and look terrible in others. You use a Sony LUT and a Sony camera, it looks, you know, one scene will look fantastic. If it didn't shoot it through the LUT in the next scene, it could look terrible. A lot of times what I'll do is I just toss out the LUT. I mean, I'll have it as like a reference. Oh, this is what they were after? Or this is what they were after. A lot of times it was, this is what they were after. So I have enough experience. I'll just make my own LUT. I'll do my own color correction. I'll take the LUT, say, okay, that's what they wanted, but that doesn't look really good on my monitor because they might not have the right monitor. And when they set up the shot, it's just, there's a lot of things that can go south as people, as you know. I mean, it's a tough job being out there under pressure and getting the shot right.
Now, I know that one of the, and I think you mentioned it before, but one of the things that people think that shooting log will do is prevent, you know, the highlights from clipping. So if you're in a scenario where you're in a room, maybe you're shooting an interview, mm-hmm. and you have light coming through a window that you cannot control or you cannot balance inside, is shooting a log profile going to save that versus 709 with underexposing the window?
No.
You'll still be able to pull up mids and blacks.
There was a documentary that I worked on, and a good friend of mine was a director on it, and they had a subject who was black, and he was against a bright window, and my friend said to me, "Oh, the DP said don't worry about it. It's log. You'll be able to rescue it." Wasn't able to rescue it. I mean, it was so blown out. He was so dark. There was no light on him. It was just an impossible. He ended up doing a reshoot on it. And that's, you got to watch those, you know, I've done a couple of recreate shows where they, you know, the DP is in love with having a really bright background and they put very little light on the subject. And it's a challenge to, you know, keep your highlights within range and try to bring up, you know, your midtones and your blacks enough so you can see something going on, because, you know, you still have the range of the sensor. Like you said, you don't magically have this gigantic range of light that you could have access to. I mean, if you're getting blown out by a window and back and you don't have any light on your subject in the foreground, log is not going to rescue the shot. I mean, we can do our job. The problem too is when you start to bring up, When you have dark scenes, you start to bring up the gain on that. You start to get noise, and the problem with 8-bit, we'll get into this probably soon. If you can get banding situations also, which is like that's a rough thing to do.
Now let's talk about 8-bits and 10-bits because for a long time at the New Jersey Final Cut Pro User Group, we would have constant meetings about codecs.
Yeah.
And bit depth, mm-hmm. and things like that. So I thought everyone understood 8 and 10 bit, but you're still seeing 8 bit footage coming into your color suite.
Yes.
Which is surprising to me, but if you just want to give us a quick 8 bit 10 bit, you know, comparison.
Well, the thumbnail only 8 bit 10 bit. 8 bit gives you about 256 steps of color. 10-bit gives you 1,024, that range of steps of color. Quite a, you know, four and a half times
more.
Now the number of colors goes from 16 million at 8-bit to like over 1 billion at 10-bit. And where you see the issues are if you're in a situation where you have bright light and then a flat wall with some sort of light fall off and it's out of focus, you'll see banding. In 8-bit, you won't see that in 10-bit. So, if you're in a challenging lighting situation, I would always capture at the highest bit rate you possibly could.
Now, here's a question, and I will say this in full disclosure, I do work as a consultant for Panasonic, and at one point Panasonic had a camera they were bringing to market called the AF100. Mm-hmm. And it had SDI output. And, of course, SDI is capable of passing 10-bit information. Right. And if you physically plug in a BNC with a monitor, it may even just register as 10-bit. When we looked at the spec and we asked the engineers, they didn't say, yes, it was 10-bit. And we were like, well, what is it then if it's not 10-bit? And they said it's 8-bit enhanced. And I was like, what is 8-bit enhanced? Because it is possible that you have a camera. Yeah. Now, I don't know if this is still the case, because I don't know what cameras internally are doing these days completely. I know that the cameras I have are 10-bit architecture. This camera was 8-bit architecture. Mm. So even though the spigot, the SDI connector, was a 10-bit connection, the camera was not putting out 10 bits of information.
Right.
So now you may be recording on a 10-bit recorder, but you don't have 10 bits of information. Oh, does that make it any better?
No.
It does not.
No, it does not.
So not only do you have to know if you have an 8-bit or a 10-bit camera.
Right.
And this gets into some decision-making, probably with your colorist before you go into production.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Like, what cameras are you going to use?
Right.
Okay, are they 8-bit? If they're 8-bit, fine. Don't shoot log. Stay within, you know, an exposure range.
Yep.
And if it is 10-bit, okay, you know, make sure we're getting a 10-bit workflow all the way through, even to the recorder.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, I mean, that's, you know, a lot of DSLRs right now are 10-bit capable, but only if you have like an Atmos or
external
an external recorder. And that's, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, well, we have this and, you know, I don't want to rent it. I don't want to buy it. I'm going to shoot internally. Well, that's only 8-bit. And that's an issue. You know, a lot of times I'll see too on independent films is that they'll have a great A camera. They'll have a Vericam or, well, not anymore, not a Vericam, but a Sony F7 or something like that, a decent camera. And then they'll choose something that doesn't match at all. So if you're going to shoot two cameras, try to use the same camera. That's one less thing to worry about, because sometimes you can't match it to the way you want to match it. What happens is you take your better camera and you have to dumb it down to what the bad camera is. You know, you're shooting in a mirror in like an A7, you know, it's just very tough. So if you have the luxury of a multiple camera shoot, use the same camera and white balance on the same card, even throw up a chip chart at the start too, just to, you know, give a little extra help. But getting back to the pipeline, yeah. I mean, I've had instances. Well, we were talking earlier before we started about green screen. I've done a lot of green screen, and you never want to shoot green screen in 8-bit. The reason is because of the fewer steps of color, and what happens is the edges get a little mushy, and you can't pull a clean key. You'll start to see banding on the green screen when you try to pull a key on it. If you're going to shoot a green screen, always shoot a 10-bit. Make sure your subject's separated from the screen. Look online. There's a lot of guides online, and do some tests if you possibly can. If you have the luxury of having a colorist early on in your project, send some test shots. This is what we're planning on doing. This is what we're planning on shooting with.
Well, I would say, and you could confirm or deny this, but I mean, if you were about to shoot an independent feature, and maybe it's you're doing it out of your own pocket,
right?
And you're thinking about doing log, or you're thinking about doing something like RAW or whatever it is that you think is the right thing, probably getting with a colorist ahead of time will save you time and money in post.
Absolutely.
Probably more than they realize.
Yes.
Going into production.
I would absolutely, if you can do it, get a colorist on board, shoot some test shots. I mean, it's only it take you half a day, shoot some test shots, and see how the cameras, number one, match up if you have two cameras. Try to do some different lighting situations, see how the camera holds up. So you know what to expect, and that way the colorist knows what to expect. And if you're planning on doing any sort of, you know, quote unquote look, that's when you start to do it, because you have to shoot for certain types of looks. You can't just take something and say, oh, I want this to look like Wes Anderson after the fact. You've got to go in shooting that way, art directing that way, lighting that way. I mean, you can't make something. It's very difficult and time consuming, and you might not get the result that you want unless you do some testing early on and decide what you want it to look like early on. I had a feature many years ago, and they wanted to look quote-unquote the Ondine look. There was a movie called Ondine, I guess, and So I looked at the film, it looked great. It was all this like blue, but it was all shot that way. And I tried to apply that to their film and it just didn't work.
So, now, in that case, if someone's trying to shoot a movie with a look or a spot mm-hmm. with a look or something, is that a good use case for log?
Yes. Yeah. That's a good case for log. You can push it. You can push log. If you have log in 10 bit, you could push it probably a little bit harder and it gives you a little bit of wiggle room. But I mean, it's something that, you might want to design a LUT ahead of time.
Right. Well, you still need to know what it's going to look like on exactly. set so you can gauge whether you're clipping or
correct.
Crushing it too much.
Correct. Yeah.
But I mean, that's a good use case for a log correct. Shoot mm-hmm. is some sort of a color effect exactly. that, you know, you're going to use continuously.
Right. Exactly. And sometimes log will give you room to match poorly matched cameras better. If you have a very contrasty camera and a camera that's, if you're trying to match a 5D with a Namira, you know, it might give you, but you know, there's a fake, I think you probably know better than I do, but kind of a false log profile for the 5D that I've, you know, seen come across. And that's something you find out in your tests though, early on, you know, is this going to work? You know, so.
Testing very important.
Yeah.
And a lot of people skip that thinking they don't need to for whatever reason, but usually that will come back and bite you in the end.
Yeah. If you have the luxury, I mean, I quite honestly, most of the stuff I do, it's like, here it is. Okay. Whatever you got, we'll do something with it. It's not the perfect way to go. The difficult, getting back to log, we talked about bad situations with log, shooting in mixed light situations. I had one show where they shot inside a warehouse. It had sodium vapor lamps, fluorescent lamps, and then daylight. And to make them look human was they were orangey in some situations, they were blue in others, you know, using just a general color correction. So I had to go and pull out keys on the faces and things like that. So in mixed light situations, especially, you got to be careful.
That's one of those things where a little bit of time and perhaps money in production mm-hmm. could have saved a lot of money in post trying to right. salvage it.
$100 of gel to throw up on the window saves, 8 hours at, $150, $200 an hour.
And probably gives you a better look.
Correct.
Yeah.
It does.
Now, this was actually someone was asking me today, and I'm still surprised that people don't fully understand the data path and the data pipe. Not just log and 8-bit, 10-bit, but ProRes. They want to shoot ProRes, and there's, you know, like 6 or 7 flavors of ProRes mm-hmm. now, mm-hmm. 444, XQD, then you have regular ProRes, and you have LT, and you have Proxy, yeah. And, you know, my feeling is you have to look at what the camera's putting out. I know people think that if they go to HQ or 444, that they're making the picture better. True or false?
If the camera's capable of it, yes.
If it's not capable of it,
you know.
I think people falsely assume that just recording at a higher bit rate is going to make the footage better. And you do have to match the camera source right. to the recording component. That data pipeline has to match. And if you're not gaining anything, all you're doing is waiting your media by a 2x, 3x factor, and then you have to store it, you have to push it around, it just takes more time.
Right, exactly, and that's for independent films, I mean, that's a consideration. That's why a lot of, you know, we talked about 8-bit on the DSLRs, well, you know, that's what a lot of guys do. You know, they it's all they have the resources for, the money, or the DP doesn't have all the gear, and they can't afford to rent it, so they have to do it that way. And when you're out on a reality shoot, there was one scene that was done for a show that I worked on earlier this year. They shot, I want to say 16 hours of multiple cameras on and off, 16 hours for like a 1 minute segment. So it's just a gigantic amount of material. So you have to weigh with how much you're going to be shooting, with how much storage you have and all that. I mean,
not everybody has the budget of the big, you know, the big movies where they shoot raw and they have all these arrays and all that other nonsense. So.
Right. And that's also the case with 4K now, which reminds me, what is your feeling on raw? And I know this new Blackmagic camera comes with a flavor of Blackmagic raw.
I don't have a lot of experience with raw because in the reality world, it's basically 709. The independent features I've done have all shot with either ProRes, you know, a 10-bit ProRes variant, or they've shot and it's been edited on Avid, and that's been shot at 175x or 220. Well, it's 175x because 2398. Sometimes you'll have some insert shots at a higher frame rate, but it's raw is I've experimented with raw and it's tremendous because not only is it a high bit rate, it also has a higher color bit rate, like 12 bit, and that gives you even more information and more steps than 10 bit color. But it's not like HDR. Raw is not HDR, but you know, it gives you more information to work with. I've seen it and I've experimented with it where the background's completely blown out and you can dial it in, and if the foreground's lit well, it's just like, oh my God, you can rescue so much more
in raw.
In raw, yeah, it's just amazing. But you know, the raw that I've experimented with has all been shot by guys who knew what they were doing,
right?
And tested, I'm sure. And
it's a heavy data pull.
It's a very heavy data pull, so that's why I don't see too much of it, because it just requires so much.
I've shot raw once for one project with my drone, and I get why they have to do it in certain circumstances, because sometimes the cameras cannot process, debayer and record 709, you know, 6K 709 in real time.
Yeah.
Like you'd be dropping frames in the camera.
Wow.
Because it just takes too much processor.
Right.
You'd overheat the camera, you'd burn batteries or both or whatever. So by using RAW, they bypass that whole debayering component.
Gotcha.
And they can record the data much easier. It's just bits and there's no processing on
Interesting.
It.
Interesting.
So I get it. Like DJI designed that little X7 gimbal to do 6K RAW because they don't have the processing to put it into 709.
Right.
You know, color space.
But then you have to do it when you get back to the office.
Right, but you still have to pay the tax.
Right.
So that goes, I don't remember the bit rates and the data throughput, but it's like a 10x factor over what I normally do in 4K.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, granted it's 6K, but it's still a lot of data.
It's a lot, yeah.
So for certain things, like I know, like my Varicam LTs, if I put it into RAW, SDI RAW mode, I can do 240 frames per second at 4K.
Wow.
But I can't do that in any other mode except 1080 crop.
Wow.
So it all has to do with the processing power of the cameras.
Right.
And right. RED, that's how RED is doing these high frame sizes, because they're bypassing the processing. Hmm. And doing it, you know, in a compressed RAW format.
Are you able to monitor that at all? I mean, or is it just you have to just let
you
it go?
I haven't done it on the Varicam. On the DJI, you can monitor it. It puts a LUT on a DJI RAW LUT onto your interface on your DJI app.
Right. Oh wow. There's been talk about 4K for a lot of reality shows, and the reality houses are fighting it tooth and nail, because you know a lot of, especially the GoPro stuff, we'll get a lot. Sometimes there'll be mess ups in the field, and they'll record at 25 frames a second, or they'll do it at some odd frame rate, and it takes absolutely forever to transcode these drone materials, this GoPro material. And the amount of footage that's associated with each show. It's just astonishing. And to think that you got, what was it, four times for 4K off of HD? Color would be the easy part. Just having the storage for it, I mean, it's just impractical, given the shooting style and the shooting ratios of reality shows right now. you know, you could do a, you can do a Mrs. Maisel, which looks great in HDR, by the way. That's my favorite show in HDR so far. But you know, they're shooting scripted, and it's a totally different animal than doing a reality show.
I will invite you back if you'll come, and we will do a separate podcast on HDR.
Oh yeah,
because that's a whole thing that I'm not too versed in, and I haven't approached that that water yet.
Yeah, it's something I'm keeping an eye on. I'm seeing some HDR 10 jobs now because it's not Dolby Vision. You have to be licensed for Dolby Vision. Dolby Vision is basically a method of you're able to tailor the data stream to the device that's receiving it, from what I understand. Again, it's like, I know enough to be dangerous with it, but I'm not an expert in it yet. So it's one of those things I'm keeping an eye on, though, because I think it's exciting. The stuff that's done well in HDR and to my eye, Mrs. Maisel's done great. And from what I understand from folks that I know, the DP on Mrs. Maisel, on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which is on Amazon Prime, he really knows his stuff. And it's just the images that he gets are just gorgeous.
So we've been talking for quite a while, which is great. But let's try to summarize this a little bit. I wanted to ask you about maybe give me one or two things that a DP can do in production before he gets to the color suite that will make his job and your job easier.
Get matching cameras. Shoot 709 unless you have a very specific situation where you can control this light. You can control the light and you know exactly what you're doing in certain situations. Do not use log for a run and gun situation. And I'd say talk about and manage expectations if with your director. Ask the director, what look are you going for on this? That's a big thing, to make sure that you know you're on the same page as the director. That way, when the director's sitting in the color suite going, hey, you know, I wanted something different than this, you know, you're going to avoid that. So communication is really, obviously, it's a big part of this business, and I don't think you can, you know, over talk about production. I mean, anybody who's involved in it, like us, we love talking about this. So, you know, it's not an imposition to talk and ask questions too. If you're not really sure, ask questions. And if you have the opportunity, test. I mean, I know a lot of colorists out there would just say, oh yeah, send me some test footage. I'll grade it up for you. Take a look. You know.
One other thing I wanted to ask you about, because you've seen the transformation, mm-hmm. DaVinci Resolve.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not even certain how I feel about DaVinci Resolve. I don't use it. I'm not a colorist. I'm an editor. I know they're trying to make it into this all-in-one tool, but they really, DaVinci was a hardware-based million-dollar product that mostly high-end post-production houses used in the 80s and 90s.
Yes. Yeah,
and then they went out of business.
Right. Well, they were bought out by Blackmagic.
Okay, whatever the situation. Blackmagic acquired them for, you know, next to nothing.
Right.
And then they took their technology and turned it into software-based. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you use Resolve.
I do, yes.
Is that your go-to tool?
Well, it depends. I mean, reality world is 90% Avid. I mean, the places where I work, I have 100 seats, and we're running up against air dates, so it's Avid Symphony, and it's a terrific tool because of the relational color grading in Avid. It's very easy to use. But what I mean by relational color grading, if you have a certain shot and you color it, Avid will pick up all the other instances of that shot or of the same clip in your timeline. DaVinci does that also, but it's more of a setup process with DaVinci, so you have to have it, you know, really set up well. I love Resolve because anything I can think of, it does, and I love that. The drawback with Resolve is the round trip is still not bulletproof, and if you're walking into a situation, well, I just did a documentary series, and I try to do the directors want a specific look for the recreation scene. So I tried it in Nav and they didn't like it. So I said, all right, what do you want? Let's talk more. Well, I want grain. I want this. I want, you know, all these different things. Okay. Came up with a look in like 5 minutes in Resolve and I loved it. So that's the power of Resolve. But the issue is we had to get the clips from Avid into Resolve. And there's, unless this, the project is set up in the, from the beginning that you know you're going to be going into Resolve, it can, you can be missing clips. So there was a kind of a pain to get the project into Resolve. And then getting it out of Resolve was easier because I just created a single clip and just exported that. But it, the round trip is still not bulletproof 100%. And it's tough to walk into a project at the end and say, okay, we're going to use Resolve and it's going to be perfect. You have to set the Resolve round trip up from the beginning. So that's one of the things. I also have base light for Avid. Base light's a great color grading tool. I love it. It's clunky because you have to step into the effect. It's not quite as quick as the Symphony way of doing things. I've played with, Nakoda's is a great color correction tool. Again, it's got its issues with round tripping. The big problem with all the color systems nowadays, except for Avid, if you go outside your primary NLE, you're gonna unless you've got a bulletproof round trip method, you're gonna have some hiccups getting the footage from Avid into Resolve and back from Resolve back into Avid and vice versa.
I think that's any system. Yeah. I mean, the minute you go out of its ecosystem,
yeah,
there's gonna be little wrinkles.
Right. Exactly. And you know, I've read of people have it really well, have it down, and but they've had the luxury of saying, dictating what the workflow is going to be. The big thing is in Avid and Resolve is to make sure you have your. I think they have a something called the media name or card name or something like that. You have in the old Avid, you had to name the tape in order for it all to work properly. And they have a, and I've forgotten it because I just read this the other day, that the Avid now has a card number as a media identifier. So that helps out a lot because it's all this metadata that goes into identifying the round trip. And sometimes it just hiccups, you know, especially when you're talking about GoPro stuff that might not have contiguous time code. And there's all sorts of, there's a lot of methods you can do to get around that. And that's, sort of another.
I do think, and I don't know if you've seen this in conversations with people, but I do think that people have this sense about Resolve that it's, again, a little bit like Log. It's magical. I must go from Final Cut, Avid, Premiere. I must color correct in Resolve because it's going to make it magic, and then it's going to come back and it's going to be great. And I don't know about you. I mean, as a editor who does some basic level color correction, I find the tools in Final Cut 10 to be very, very good.
I agree with you.
Do you think that people have that false sense that they have to use Resolve because it's going to make their product better?
I think people think that, oh, well, if I go to Resolve, it's going to have all the toys, it's going to solve all my issues, and everything's going to be just fine. And it's the person behind the who's driving it, really. And it Resolve is great, but it's very deep. And a lot of what people need to do is match shot to shot, and you can do that with basic tools, but it takes time to learn how to do that in a quick manner. But I like the tools in Final Cut Pro 10 a lot. I mean, they're actually the same color science from Color, which I loved. I loved Apple Color.
That was a strange move, wasn't it?
I'm still upset about that. It had the nicest interface. You had your curves on the main page there. You had everything laid out. I mean, I use curves all the time. I use curves primarily in Avid, and in Resolve, I use Lift Gamma Gain with the balls and stuff like that. But, you know, Apple Color had both in the main page. It was just really a really good system, and I'm still upset about it going away.
Yeah, we'll do another session and bash Apple a bit on some of their moves.
Yeah, I'm telling you, they were just It was a great color correcting system, and I still miss it. But getting back to Resolve being an end all be all, it's all a matter of the brains behind the wheel.
And, like anything,
you know, and it can rescue things to an extent. What it is time. I mean, if you made a mistake on your shoot with colorist, we'll probably be able to make it look a hell of a lot better. It's a matter of how long it's going to take them to do that. If you have a budget for 3 days and you have a lot of errors on your, you know, for a short film, and you have a bunch of stuff that's really tough, it's going to take 5 days. You know, it's just time. And, you know, and that's what you have to think about. I mean, the problem with production is, and that's an additional pressure on the folks who are out there shooting and gathering this material, is that it snowballs from the get-go. You know, if you do it right, then everything will be smooth. If you mess up something a little bit, well, then it can take on its own life.
If you mess it up on day one and don't fix it,
right,
it's a lot of pain at the end.
It is a lot of pain at the end. It's a lot of time from anything from your audio mixer. If you don't get all the right, if you have to repair audio, I mean, and if you have to repair video, or you have to go out and shoot pickups again because something messed up. So, you know, it's...
Keeps us employed.
Yes, it does. It does.
Vern, I want to thank you very much for being a guest on This Week in Production.
My pleasure, Art. My pleasure.
And I will certainly have you back anytime.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. I really enjoyed it.